Well, good morning, everybody. And I hope this is a good day for you, especially if you're a mother. You had a mother? You have a mother? Yes. I think that's a lot better than a birthing person. Talking about science deniers. I'm not sure. I kind of that crossed my mind too.
I've heard in the past that if statistically, if you didn't have a mother, let's see. That's all out of the. That's out of there now. Doesn't matter.
Okay. You got to watch those statistics. They say that like 86% of them are made up on the spot, including that one.
The sad thing is that since reason is no longer necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the craziness that all of this is going to lead to rationally won't matter because it's what you feel that matters. And so you can't pin anything down, but I don't know. God is with us. That's the comfort.
Sounds like you're trying to make sense of things. I'm not sure. Well, welcome to all of you. Great to have the students from afar. And near, back again. And it's good to be back as well.
From the ocean.
From the ocean, yes. Delivering rocking chairs. We had kind of an unexpected treat halfway through the trip. We got to South Carolina where we needed to deliver, and the store there is only open like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and we got there Wednesday about 1 o'clock. So we had half a day on our hands. But we were only about 30 minutes from the ocean, and so we went there. As soon as we got there, it started a really heavy thunderstorm. Totally cleared the beach. And when it was over, we had it to ourselves. So it was great.
Were you able to park the trailer back at the store?
So we got a motel there in the Georgetown, South Carolina is the name of the town. And then it was just Pauli Island. Pauli Island is where we...
the first resort community in America or in the United States.
Okay. A little bit of trivia there. And... they're known in history for their raising of rice. At one time, they were one of the largest rice producers in the world. But there wasn't much in the world then. So some records just don't mean as much, you know. Okay. Well, Isaiah chapter 29. I have just a tinge of feedback still or not. You can't tell from there. Very slightly. Mr. Dan still hears things.
Oh, a lot of it.
Yeah, I know there's always some feedback from the audience. Okay. What do you expect when you sit in front of the speaker? So, we started Isaiah 29 last week, and in this chapter, we have Isaiah referring to Jerusalem as Ariel. You may remember from last week and speaking there of its distress to come. But as well in this chapter, we have some fascinating verses. At least they're fascinating if you're a student of the Bible and have seen them in other places. And one of the things that I found so appealing about Isaiah is when I read it, realizing that this is a book that tremendously influenced the perception, the understanding, the self-understanding of the early church, and their interpretation of Jesus and his life, who he was, and the way in which he fulfilled prophecy. And whenever you make the connections between verses that you've read in the New Testament in Isaiah, it's directly parallel to the ways in which they made connections to the life of Christ and verses in Isaiah. Because Isaiah was a huge part of their Bible, their scripture. This is a part of the body of their consciousness of what God's revelation was all about. We look at the whole Bible now, and many times we're much more in touch with things in the New Testament. But realizing that this is what created for them the fullness of the reality of Jesus and his fulfillment of scriptures. I really am connecting with that in our study of it here. And so we find here, we were partway through this chapter, we had the metaphors there of the dreams, the hungry man who was eating in his sleep and then woke up, and the thirsty man likewise. So just the opposite of what we often do with bad dreams. With bad dreams, we're trying to wake ourselves up so we can get out of this terrible predicament we're in. But in this case, it's like, oh, don't let me wake up. This is great. I'm eating at last. But alas, I have awoken, and it's not the case. Yes. Oh, you guys are so nosy.
Well, last time you were lamenting the fact you forgot to, and I wasn't for sure.
I had forgotten to. So. Truth be told. Okay, everybody happy now?
Ask the Davises, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, they had to leave early today, and so they asked to Zoom. So if I can get the type big enough for everybody, we'll be all right. So I wanted to start reading here. Right where I am. He says, "For the Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and hath closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered." this is an image that we see then reflected also in the New Testament. Jesus blew the minds of everybody he encountered. Whether they were his enemies or his friends. And one of the things that we read his enemies saying is, "Never man spoke like this man," right? In response to the officers were expected to bring him in for questioning him, arrest him or something, and they got to listen to what he was saying, and they gave up on it. And whenever they were challenged by it, they said, "Nobody talks like this. It's like, you go do it, you know, if you're so up on it." But then as well, there was this sense of bepuzzlement at, just from the common person, at how God could be doing what he appeared to be doing, and the wise men of their world didn't see it coming, didn't catch it, didn't expect it. How is that possible? And so we see Isaiah speaking of it ahead of time. It's as though you're asleep. It's as though your prophets and your rulers, your seers are covered. They are out of contact, out of touch with the reality. And the vision of it all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed. Okay? And I like to contrast that then to the passage that we see in Luke 4, where we're told that Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And so as compared to Isaiah here, where we have as though a book given as though it were sealed, the learned says, "I can't read it. I can't open it because it's sealed." The ignorant say, "I can't read it because I'm not learned." We have Jesus here who took the book. And opened it and read from Isaiah, a passage which he says later in Luke was fulfilled in their ears that very day. So these words are filled with meaning when you reflect on what transpired in history and the degree to which these oracles of Isaiah were revered by the early Christians and Jews, and how that all works together. Verse 13, "Wherefore the Lord saith, forasmuch as this people draw near me with their mouth, and their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid." Okay, and so then later in this chapter, he will return to some of these words, these concepts. Most all of his writings are intricately constructed, often bracketed by various phrases or words. And so here we have the understanding of the prudent men hid. And we'll watch for an alternative to that. 15 then goes to the next woe. You remember we are in the midst of six woes here in Isaiah. And verse 15 is woe number 3. "Woe unto them that hide or that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord. And their works are in the dark. And they say, who seeth us? Who knoweth us?" Okay. What a futile effort, right? You think of perhaps watching kids play hide and seek. And there's a certain stage in life where they somehow feel like that if they can't see you, you can't see them, right? So they may stick their head under a chair or whatever, and they're not hit at all. But they think they are. Well, in fact, if you're trying to hide from God, you're like a child playing hide and seek. Isaiah says, "Woe unto them that seek to hide their counsel, their thinking, their reasoning." You know, clearly, if God is omnipresent, you can't hide your actions from Him. But, in fact, God's presence is just not a matter of physical things. You can't hide your thoughts from Him either. And so, Isaiah says, "Woe to them that seek to hide their counsel, their thinking, their reasoning from God." He says, "Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as the potter's clay. For shall the work say of him that made it, 'He made me not'? Or shall the thing framed say of him that framed it, 'He had no understanding'?" And certainly there's an illustration that appeals to your sense of reason. Clay doesn't turn into pottery by itself, of its own accord. You don't get those things through evolution or chance or any sort of random process. They are the result of careful craftsmanship by an intentioned intelligence. And so Isaiah looks at the way that man relates to God sometimes. And he says, you got the wrong end up here. You've turned things upside down. You can't read the instructions. Yes.
Sorry, just this takes me back to our discussion Wednesday night, talking about sometimes we give the devil too much credit. It's interesting that I was quite old before I realized that the devil can't read our thoughts. Mm-hmm. He can put things into our minds, but he doesn't have the power. And yet we forget, or you know, these people were clearly forgetting they're trying to hide from God, and he didn't just see them, but he saw right through them.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison mm-hmm. between the two.
Right.
They're not equal, opposite.
Mm-hmm.
One is the creator, one is just created. And he can no more read our thought. Sometimes we can tell what people are thinking
mm-hmm.
because it shows from how they behave.
Sure.
But he can't get inside our heads.
Mm-hmm.
God can.
Right. If you're pretty close to somebody, a lot of times, I've been told by those close to me, "I know what you're thinking." And they were right. But in terms of the detailed counsel, the reasoning, what you're thinking, that's a little harder to discern. You know, if you're in a familiar kind of situation, and you've had that kind of experience before, you know, if you know that your spouse doesn't like certain things to occur or to eat or whatever, you pretty much know what they're thinking when they start encountering them. But with regard to the intentions of the heart and the reasonings, that's a little bit more difficult to deduce just from familiarity. I had another thought that has escaped me. But would that God could bring it back. or would, he can. But So woe to them that seek to hide their counsel. Yes. It really does create a transformation in your life when you accurately are conscious of God and his nature. It just changes everything. I remember in my life as a young person, I was noticeably transformed when I was when I gained the perception, which wasn't actually totally true, but it was real to me, the perception that if I did something wrong, my dad would find out. Just a persuasion that he would find out somehow. And I had various experiences which sort of reinforced that. But then it just sort of became a general accepted thing in my mind. I'm not going to do that because he will find out. And I don't like what happens when he does. If people had that kind of perception about God, about whom it is not mistaken to believe he will find out, and they truly lived with that reality, that's a, by itself, is a life-transforming thing. God knows. God knows me. And if I'm a little fuzzy in my mind about something, I shouldn't assume that he is too, because he knows. And so Isaiah here is appealing to that basic fundamental fact and compares it to this pottery metaphor. Yes.
Based on what you just said, can I share just a little tid story here?
Uh-huh.
I would have been a preteen maybe by 3 or 4 years.
Uh-huh.
We had a neighbor joining farms, and the wife, her name was Neola Johnson.
Okay.
Older lady at that time, and she was a prayer warrior. She could pray.
Mm-hmm.
And I have said that I have experienced a couple of people in my life where I felt like when they prayed, it was just like they were just in the presence of the Lord talking personally with him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's how they lived their life, and it was obvious. But I had, as a young boy, I had so much confidence in Neola's praying.
Mm-hmm.
In her prayer, that I have not found the Lord yet, even as a young person, but I had so much confidence in Neola's prayers that I felt like I was afraid to do something wrong, afraid the Lord would reveal it to Neola and she'd come and confront me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I guess that's how much confidence I had in the Lord.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly wanted to walk a straight line as a young boy.
Sure. We all need a Neola in our life. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Sure, there's an element of fear there, which I think is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also just the fear in terms of, like, high respect.
Mm-hmm.
If you know somebody's going to know something about you and you don't really give a rip what they think, mm-hmm. it doesn't really change you much. But if it's someone whose respect you would like mm-hmm. to have or a relationship you'd like to have, mm-hmm. then it matters. And in terms with God, it also is a relief that you can quit pretending.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, the weight of that mm-hmm. kind of can roll off, because it's like, who are we kidding here? He knows who I am better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to, you know, work up feelings of whatever and, you know, to feel close to God or
mm-hmm.
whatever the situation might be, because he knows where I am, he knows where my heart is, and actually I need to go to him to figure it out for myself, because mm-hmm. I'm not a very good judge sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you mentioned the possibility that somebody might not care what somebody knows about them. But here again, to properly respect God and to properly comprehend who He is, you better care, right? Because He's the one who is the final judge. He is the one who ultimately is controlling the direction that everything is going in the universe. And so what He knows matters. And so you might as well give up on trying to control what He knows and concentrate on controlling that which is to be known by making sure it's worthy of being known, right? Control your behavior, control your life in a way that is pleasing to Him. And I keep using the word control, but really what it amounts to is a release of control to His will, a giving up of control. And so, and why is that such a good thing? Why is it a good thing to give up to God? And He does, right? He knows what's good. So it all goes back to a basic persuasion that God is good. He's good for me. He's good for the whole world. And if that's true, it's a pleasure to submit to His will. It's only if I can figure out better what's good for me than Him that I have this problem with hanging on. So, yes?
I'm kind of wondering if by Jesus quoting the beginning of this passage and He's sort of alluding to verse 16 to kind of blow up the rabbinic method, because the core of it is to, you know, the thing formed, say of Him who formed it, He has no understanding. I mean, that's the whole point of the rabbinic method. God has taken the law out of heaven, put it in our hands. God can't even interpret it anymore. We can. And that would be the core of what these wise men, quote unquote, are doing. And then, of course, Jesus, in quoting this, you know, if you look at verse 18, the deaf hearing and the blind seeing, He's quite literally fulfilling that in their sight.
I think you're going to continue to see a lot of connections here between what you're saying and what Isaiah says later in this chapter. And I think that it seems that Paul made some of those same connections because of what he was doing with Romans 9 and 10. Because he refers to this potter's metaphor there, right? I don't know. I don't know to what Jesus, to what extent he had all that in mind as he referred to some of these passages earlier. But certainly, it seems pretty certain that Paul was thinking in those terms by some of the things that that he said.
Well, and is that not an example of like when Jesus said what he said on the cross that referred, a sense, to the whole chapter, because the people who were hearing him say that knew the whole chapter, and that makes sense.
And since he's quoting it to the Pharisees, they would probably have this, potentially have this entire book memorized. So they would know what he's talking about.
And this reference to your wise men not having understanding, of course, that's a picture of the leading wise men of Jesus' day not knowing what's going on, and in fact refusing God's very Son in exchange for their wisdom. It's that upside down thing again, right? You've turned the world upside down. And so then verse 17, Isaiah goes far to the future with another metaphor. He says, "Is it not yet a very little while, and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest?" So Lebanon in general was a metaphor for what is constant, what is always there, and what is not a product of human endeavor. Lebanon was the source of the great cedars and great timbers that were used in throughout the ancient world for shipbuilding and for construction. And it was, nobody planted them, you know. They were there. They were seen as part of the work of God. And so this is a way of gesturing to God being the one who's going to transform the future. In that day shall the deaf hear. The words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. And the meek also shall increase their joy in the Lord, and the poor among men shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. So, you know, it almost takes my breath away as I reflect on those words and their echoes in the New Testament. We just read a minute ago about Jesus taking the book, as opposed to a book which was sealed, or a book which the unlearned were unable to read. We have the very Word of God opening the book to the poor, to the meek, to the blind, to the deaf.
Which seems upside down to us.
He continues, "For the terrible one is brought to naught, and the scorner is consumed, and all that watch for iniquity are cut off." And by that he means watches for opportunity for iniquity, not those who guard against it. "That make a man an offender for a word, and lay a snare for him that reproveth in the gate, and turn aside the just for a thing of naught." Okay, so some of those phrases are probably not things that we immediately identify with, but Alec Motyer here says that the three abuses of the legal system are mentioned here. False testimony, tampering with witnesses, and denying the innocent the protection of the law. The one who reproves in the gate is the one who stands up for on the side of those who have been wronged. So it would be the instance of tampering with witnesses. And the expression to turn aside is apparently regular usage for dismissing a case. So that would be denying justice to those who the law is supposed to protect. When values decline in a society at large, the legal processes and guardians are not immune. Wow, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? We don't realize, I think, sometimes, or we take it for granted, we have at least in the past, how much we just presume that somewhere in our world you can find justice. And usually you think of the courts as the place where that's where you find justice. Sadly, I don't need to tell you that we are increasingly faced with replacement of justice with a sort of mob action, mob rule. That's a really sad state of affairs. God's not happy with that at all. You find him condemning over and over the lack of justice in the sinfulness of Israel as it turned away from him. And some of the things that we use in replacement of justice are just lunacy. In looking at some of the headlines just the past week, of course, this is the week, of course, whenever we had the leaked Supreme Court opinion. And my wife, in our discussions, she was just like, how can that happen? How does that happen? It just doesn't make any sense. And, of course, the response by the current administration to just ignore the gravity of the breach and want to move on to make political gain from the supposed contents. What a travesty of justice. And then, of course, I think we should occasionally remind ourselves of the emptiness of the arguments of those that want to suggest that the reality of the world is that abortion is a fundamental right, that somehow our world will collapse without it. Did we mention science deniers earlier? You know that for years, China had a one-child policy. And I recently watched a documentary of some people that lived under that, and it was horrendous. I mean, they were forcing doctors to sterilize women who had had a child. And you run into this, you know, they lived in a culture where it was very important to have a son to carry on the family name. And so you had people, if they had daughters, they would just leave them outside. Maybe somebody would pick them up, maybe somebody wouldn't. Horrendous stories. And now the Chinese have realized that they don't have enough kids to support the old folks. And so they've changed their policy. 2 children. Okay, you can have 2 now. And they've gone to unbelievable extents to try to promote this kind of thing. They put on theater acts. They send people all over the country going through these silly little songs about this is such a good policy, everybody should do this, this is for our good. They did it with the one child, now they've changed it to 2 children. So this notion that gets parroted over and over, that this is just somehow a fundamental part of life. I saw one sign that said, you know, if 50 years doesn't set a precedent, nothing does. 50 years of law, because that's how long Roe v. Wade has been.
Slavery was a precedent.
Well, a few thousand years. All of human history, yes.
The logic doesn't matter with people. No, that's the sad thing.
Your view of the world is like this big.
Yes. And then the notion that that if you take away abortion, you take away a woman's right to control her body. Now, there's a major science denial there, okay? I don't think their efforts at educating children have been successful because apparently they don't know how you get to a position where you might think you need an abortion. There's choice involved. And if somehow you don't have choice there, but then you do about whether you murder the unborn baby, that's sort of a weird understanding of the world, okay? So remind yourself over and over of the nonsense that gets parroted and repeated. It's the whole principle of if we repeat a lie long enough, then it becomes accepted as true. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that are right there. They shudder to think that they would support a law that would force somebody else into a certain position. And yet, how shallow is that? We don't shudder a bit to feel like we should have a law to force people not to kill each other once they're born. Usually, we don't. And so, yes, the world upside down, is it not? And as opposed to justice, we are making people offenders for a word, right? They haven't done anything, but they said something we don't like. Witness intimidation. Yeah? If you're not on our side, we want you to shut up or else. And then just dismiss the whole thing if it's not something we're interested in. Yes?
Witness intimidation. I was talking with the new attorney at our office, and he just ran across an article where apparently in Cook County, they are jailing witnesses for not meeting with the prosecutors in their office. They will subpoena the witness to come to the office, and the judge will sign off on that, which it's not even legal under state law to do that, and then they will throw those individuals in jail if they don't come.
Okay.
So, you know, somebody's brother gets murdered, and they get subpoenaed to come to, you know, the defense office or something like that. And then they don't show up because it's not a legal subpoena, and they get thrown in jail. So the same thing happens in our day.
Yes. What protects you ultimately, right? If it isn't the fear of God, it won't be anything. That is what brings us to justice and brings us to accountability as men. These notions that you can have a society based on some other kind of morality are empty. It's not so. It doesn't work. But Isaiah then looks to a brighter day. He says, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord who redeemed Abraham concerning the house of Jacob. Jacob shall not now be ashamed, neither shall his face now wax pale. But when he seeth his children, the work of mine hands, in the midst of him, they shall sanctify my name and sanctify the Holy One of Jacob, and shall fear the God of Israel. They also that erred in spirit shall come to understanding, and they that murmured shall learn doctrine." So we talk about the message of hope that we often find in Isaiah, and this is certainly one example of that. A time whenever God's work has been accomplished in the world. And it's as though Jacob is looking down on the results of his life and the offspring of his children. And he says there's going to be a time when he's not ashamed by that. And at that time, they that have erred in spirit shall come to understanding. So this is the other bracket on that verse I spoke of earlier, where the wise men have no understanding, right? The counter to that is there will come a time. They that murmured, this particular word reflects back on the constant murmuring of the Israelites as they were coming out of Egypt. You remember over and over, God was displeased with them because you couldn't please them. There was always something wrong. They didn't have bread, and he gave them manna from heaven. They didn't have variety, had no meat, so he gave them quail until it ran out their ears, or out their nostrils, I think it says. And so that murmuring, what a terrible experience to have to endure. Have you witnessed this? Have you ever been around somebody that they couldn't be happy with anything? Especially if you did it. So you work so hard to try to please them, and you know it's the wrong color or whatever, or the wrong time of day, or who knows what. They can't be pleased, and it just destroys the joy in those that are trying to create joy. Whenever somebody responds in that way, well, God, after all He had done for the children of Israel, and causing them to come into existence as the potter with the clay, bringing them out of slavery into a glorious relationship with Him, had to constantly endure this murmuring. And Isaiah says, there shall come a time when they that murmured shall learn doctrine. They that erred shall come to understanding. Well, I know Isaiah rejoiced in that thought that that would come. He didn't see much of it in his day. But we begin to see it with the dawning of the day of Jesus, don't we? We see the blind gaining their sight and the deaf hearing, and an understanding begin to grow in the minds of His followers, of what God is looking for. A heart that is transformed, as opposed to this earlier passage which says, this people, they have drawn near Me with their mouth. They do the talk, but their heart is far from Me. That's not what God's looking for. That's not what you're looking for. You don't want relationships like that. I don't know if you've ever talked to somebody and you realize after a little bit that they are somewhere else. And every now and then they say, yeah, because that's the right thing to say. or not. But they're not there. That's not a fulfilling relationship. And so, as opposed to that, those who have received the Spirit of Christ, received the Spirit of understanding, and no longer murmur, that is a picture of what is to come. Well, we are within a minute of the anticipated bell, I suppose. Any comments or questions anybody would like to offer? So another chapter which is rich in references, connections to what we see in the New Testament. And one to remember, Isaiah 29. Well, I'm going to stop there. Thank you all for your kind attention. Thank you.
the bread.